We are going to be in Acts 22 and 23 tonight. We look at Paul's trial before Felix and some of the things that happened when he was trying to defend his work as a missionary. I've really enjoyed reading through this and doing some history and reading about Claudius Lysias and Felix and Drusilla and Ananias the high priest and some of these historical figures. And when you read this, you have to remind yourself that this is not some fairy tale. This is history. And that makes it much more meaningful. The book of Acts is a book of history, things that actually took place. And some of the things that we even do to date where we are in history of time, we can look into first century historians like Tacitus, and we can look into what Josephus wrote and others about these particular individuals that held government positions and when they ruled and what the significance of their rule was and kind of where they were politically in the midst of this work that Paul was doing. So what I want to do is, I don't have time to read this text to you, but I want to encourage you to read the text. Keep reading the text a couple of chapters at a time as we come into class. We're getting really close to the end of the book of Acts because we're going to look here at his trial before Felix, and then he'll be before Festus in chapter 25, and then before Agrippa in chapter 26. So I guess I want to remind you of what Paul's doing. Paul, remember, was going to Jerusalem. He gets to Jerusalem. He goes into the temple. The Jews don't like him being there, and they basically arrest him and put him before the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin and the Jews basically have a riot against Paul, and one of the Roman guards and chief of the garrison gives him the opportunity to make his defense before the crowd. And that is before chapter 22. And then remember in chapter 22, Paul speaks of how he was called on the road to Damascus. This is the first time we hear him speak about it since Acts chapter 9 when Luke records it. And then we'll hear it again before Agrippa in Acts chapter 26. So when you get down to verse 24 here in chapter 22 of Acts, you have Claudius Lysias. Now we know it's Claudius Lysias, chapter 23 and verse 26. Claudius Lysias is going to write a letter to Felix as he turns Paul over to him. But Paul is preaching and he's telling these Jews that God had called him and that he was going to preach the gospel. And in verse 21, everything's going along okay until he says that Jesus said unto him, "Depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles." And that was them were fighting words, I guess you'd say, for the Jews to speak of the Gentiles. And that was part of what Paul had been accused of, was bringing a Gentile, you remember, into the temple where he was not allowed to go. And so look what they say there. This man's not fit to live. And if you go down to chapter 23, look what it says in verse 10. There arose such a great dissension that the commander, again, this is Claudius Lysias. Sometimes he might be called a chiliarch, which means a chief commander, and he would have been over 1,000 men, and he was the chiliarch, or he was the chief commander of the garrison that was called the Antonius garrison in the city of Jerusalem. And it says, fearing that he might be pulled to pieces, verse 10, chapter 23, by them and taken by force among them, he asked the soldiers to go down and take him by force from the Jews and bring him to the barracks. So you have Claudius Lysias, who is kind of a commander over a Roman guard over this section of the city, and you have this uprising against Paul by the Jews, and he's protecting him. Now, in verses 24 through 29, we will look at this. This is Claudius Lysias, orders Paul to be brought to the barracks. And he says, let's examine him under scourging. What would that have been like? Scourging. Jesus was scourged, you remember. And he was scourged to the point that he was basically in critical condition by the time he was done. So you would take a man with leather straps, and you would attach him to a pole, kind of bent over like this, where his back was exposed, and then you would beat him. And that was the Roman way of getting information. And so Paul is in this situation where he's about to be beaten. And this is according to Claudius Lysias' command. But look what he says in verse 25. Paul said to the centurion who stood by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?" Okay, so we'll stop with that. And I want to talk a little bit about Roman citizenship. And there's inside the page here of my Bible, there's some good information on this about Roman citizenship. And Paul appealed to different people that were involved in government concerning his Roman citizenship. There were rights that came with it, and many times kind of saved Paul's neck. So here I want to read about Paul's Roman citizenship. What was the significance of that? The Apostle Paul was born at Tarsus, chief city of the Roman province of Cilicia in the south in Southeast Asia Minor. While he was thoroughly Jewish by nationality, he was also born a Roman citizen, a privilege which worked to his advantage on several occasions during his ministry. As the ruling world power of Paul's time, the Romans consolidated their empire by granting Roman citizenship to certain non-Romans. Paul's parents must have enjoyed this right before him, and he automatically became a Roman citizen at birth. So Paul's parents were also Jews, but they were given Roman citizenship, and then by the time Paul was born, he was born a Roman citizenship, a Roman citizen. Roman citizen could not be bound or imprisoned without trial. Neither could he be beaten or scourged, the common form of torture used by the Romans to extract a confession from a prisoner. Finally, if a Roman citizen felt he was not receiving a fair trial under local authorities, he could appeal his cause to Rome, which is exactly, you remember, what Paul does. And that's what eventually is going to lead him to Caesar in Rome. Paul and his partner Silas were bound, beaten, and imprisoned by Roman authorities in Philippi. Remember Acts chapter 16. Paul made it clear that they were Roman citizens, and therefore the authorities quickly released them and begged them to leave town. Later in Jerusalem, Paul was taken into protective custody by Roman soldiers as a group of Jewish zealots threatened his life. That's chapter 22. He was spared by scourging by the soldiers, granted a hearing before their commander when he revealed his Roman citizenship. That's right where we are right now. Soldiers also gave him safe passage out of Jerusalem when the zealots persisted their threats against Paul. We'll get to that in chapter 23. Imprisoned by Roman officials at Caesarea for 2 years, that's Acts 25, 24 and 25, Paul finally appeals to Rome, and he was sent on a merchant ship to Rome in Acts 27, where he spent 2 years under house arrest, and here he was allowed to preach and make converts, and that's the end of the book of Acts. Even the tradition that Paul was beheaded in Rome shows the influence of his Roman citizenship. Non-Roman criminals were generally crucified. Beheading was a more honorable and merciful form of capital punishment reserved for Roman citizens. That makes you think about what Jesus suffered on the cross. And basically what they're saying is if you were beheaded, you were getting out of it easy. Okay, it reminds us that Jesus truly did suffer in the worst way at the hands of the Roman guards. So there's some things about Roman citizenship that are important. So here's what Lysias is dealing with. The commander, verse 27 of chapter 22, comes and says to Paul, "Are you a Roman?" And he says, "Yes." And again, Lysias says, "Well, I obtained my citizenship by a large sum of money." I was actually looking into his name, Lysias, which was a Greek name, but Claudius was a Roman connotation. And what I read about that was it was likely that it was under the reign of Claudius that he was given the opportunity to make this purchase of his Roman citizenship, and thus those names were put together. So you had a Greek and a Roman name mixed together to make Claudius Lysias. But look what Paul says, "I was born a citizen." So Paul is actually saying that my citizenship was obtained more in a more noble way. A person that was born a Roman citizen would have been honored even above one who had obtained it through the purchase of money. So it says in verse 29, "Immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him. The commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman and because he had bound him." So he'd already done some things illegal with Paul, with him being a Roman citizen. Okay, verse 30. The next day, because he wanted to know for certain why Paul was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priest and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. So in chapter 23, Paul is going to come before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin or the council. Remember in Acts, the council and the Sanhedrin, those are synonyms. But this was the Jewish council made up of Pharisees and Sadducees, and the high priest usually ruled over it. And there was usually 70 or 71 in attendance, and they would sit there in a semicircle and listen to Paul's statement. And then Paul says this in chapter 23 in front of the Sanhedrin, "I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." An interesting statement by Paul, and he is going to, again, argue to them that what he's doing is what God has asked him to do, is commissioned by God. But what Paul says, "I've lived before God in all good conscience until this day," reminds us of the life of Paul. Now, can you live in good conscience and still be wrong? Yeah, he's an example of that. He thought what he was doing was the right thing even when he was persecuting the church. But we will at least say this about Paul. Paul always followed what he believed to be right, even when he was misinformed. And so we give Paul credit for that. He did live before God in good conscience. And that's kind of what he's trying to say. Remember, he's in Jerusalem, and people didn't know what to make of Paul in Jerusalem. Well, part of his life he persecuted the church. Part of his life he tried to advance the church. So who is this Paul? And you could understand why the Jews hated him, those that didn't want to accept Christ, because now he was going against the very thing that Jesus had basically broken down. And that was the Jewish system of life under the law of Moses and under the Sanhedrin. It was a complete breakdown of those things, and it was against it. So it says in verse 2 here that the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. So evidently they struck him on the mouth. And then Paul has an objection to that. Ananias, by the way, ruled as high priest from the late 40s into the late 50s A.D. And one of the ways that we know exactly what time this was 57 A.D. In 59 A.D., Festus takes over for Felix, and there's a two-year period of Paul's being held by Felix until Festus takes over. You also have Drusilla, who's married to Felix, and she was born in 38 A.D., and so she was only about 19 when Felix took her away from another man that she was married to politically and brought her along to be his wife. So Paul is going to appear before Felix here in chapter 24. And Felix was the procurator of Palestine. He was a Roman governor, if you will, during that time, from about 52 to 59 A.D. until he was let go by Caesar and he was replaced by Festus. So there's a lot of interesting things that are wrapped up in that. And we'll maybe get to that eventually. So what's going to happen here in chapter 23 is Paul continues to speak before the high priest and before the Sanhedrin, and they're just not going to give him a good audience. They are not on his line of thinking. They want him to be persecuted. So here's what he says in verse 6. This is where he realizes, okay, I'm not going to make any headway with these people, so I'm just going to divide them. He says, "I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, and concerning the hope of the resurrection of the dead, I'm being judged." Again, the Sadducees didn't believe in a resurrection. The Pharisees believed in a resurrection. And the Pharisees are saying, hey, and they also believed in spirit beings. The Pharisees believed in life after death and angels and spiritual entities. The Sadducees denied that such existed. So if Paul made a statement that was in line with one of them, was basically their major conflict, then he just kind of, you know, he just threw a bunch of dogs and cats together and tried to let them work it out. So they're about to get so riled up here, they're going to split Paul in two, and so Lysias takes him back. And that's verse 10. So he's taken back to the barracks, and Lysias is deciding what he's going to do with Paul. And it says in verse 11 that the Lord the following night stood by him and said, "Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome." This must have helped Paul. Paul was a human being just like everybody else. And I'm sure that as he went before all these different hearings and different moments of being arrested and almost beaten, many times he was beaten. You know, we talked about the times he was stoned. He must have had fearful moments. And here, Jesus himself is saying, you're going to make it to Rome. So you're not going to die in Jerusalem. And that must have given Paul some comfort. From time to time we see, whether through a vision that Paul receives or a message from an angel or perhaps even the words of Jesus, him being built up and encouraged to continue his work as a missionary. So basically Jesus is saying, Paul, just keep on doing what you're doing. God isn't finished with you yet. Okay, so now verses 12 and following through 22, there arises a plot. The Jews are getting nowhere with Paul. They want to see him put to death. He's antagonistic to them. And so there's 40 men that decide to take a vow, these zealots. Now here's the irony in all this. We have Ananias as the high priest. And by the way, he was not born properly through the seed of Aaron. And he was a very, very wicked, and he loved money. Everything that I read about him said he loved money. And the irony is that later on, Ananias is put to death by a group of zealots just like this in AD 66 because of his pro-Roman tendencies. He was just too much involved in government, and the Jews that were always trying to push back against the Roman government decided to kill their own high priest at some particular time. But here they're trying to kill Paul, and 40 of them come together and they say, hey, we're not going to eat or drink or anything until Paul's put to death. We're under a vow. So you tell, you Sanhedrin, you council, you tell Claudius Lysias that you want to talk to him one more time. And while he's being let out to meet you again, we'll kill him. Well, it just so happens that Paul, who's had been living in Jerusalem for some time and has family there, his nephew overhears of the plot. And so he goes to the barracks of Lysias and he uncovers the plot. And Paul is secretly rescued by Lysias and taken at night up to Caesarea. Now Caesarea is the Roman seat of government in Palestine. Caesarea was where Pilate's place was. Caesarea was where Herod's palace was. In fact, when Paul is taken by Claudius Lysias and these troops up to safety, he's put in Herod's palace. Of course, Herod would have been the Jewish king that was allowed to still rule under the Roman government. So Herod the Great and Herod Antipas and some of these other Herods, and Agrippa, they're the Jewish part of the government that the Romans are allowing to still exist in Palestine. And Herod had this great palace. It was all white stone, and it covered 165 acres. And in that praetorium, or in that particular place where there was safety, that's where Paul's going to be kept. And here's the letter from Claudius Lysias, and I think this is kind of humorous. So he says, okay, we're going to protect Paul here. There's a Jewish plot to kill him. We already know he's a Roman citizen. We need to protect him at this point. Claudius Lysias has tried to save his own skin because he knows that he had almost beaten Paul without any right, and he had already arrested him and tied him up without right. So he had already made some mistakes. But Claudius Lysias is going to use this opportunity to advance himself politically. So here's the letter, chapter 23, starting in verse 26. Claudius Lysias, that's him addressing, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him worthy of death or chains. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. So Lysias is saying, because I'm such a wonderful guy, I'm saving Paul. Where, remember, he was about to beat him. He was going to beat him down and get some answers. But now he has flipped that so that he can look good before Felix, who's one of his superiors. So he sends them off, and they come by about 35 miles here in verse 31. And the horsemen go on with them, and several of the troops go back. They're no longer needed. He's safe. They come to Caesarea. They deliver the letter, and they present Paul before Felix. And so there's going to be a little time lag here. Look at verse 20 of chapter 24. After 5 days, Ananias the high priest comes down with the elders. So here's what Lysias has said. I'm going to put him before you, you can take it up with these Jews here that want to accuse Paul, and if they want to accuse him, they can come and visit Caesarea. So they just hold Paul in the barracks or there at Herod's palace for 5 days until Ananias and the rest of these Jews come down and present their case before Felix to try and accuse him of, well, several different things. And when we get to chapter 24, this is kind of humorous to me. There's this guy named Tertullus. Look at verse 1. A certain orator. What does that tell you? He's kind of like the lawyer here in a sense that is speaking on behalf of the Sanhedrin. He's a hired hand. But they get Tertullus because he's an orator. What does that mean? What do you think it means? He's a sweet speaker. And he's going to see if he can convince Felix to do something to Paul. And basically, and all historians say about Tertullus, even in looking at the speech, is he was padding his weak case with flattering words. So Tertullus comes down and he knows how to talk. So they hire this guy and they say, we're going to use him. He's Johnny Cochran, I guess, or something like that. I don't know. And he comes down and he's going to try and make it look bad for Paul. Although, I guess it would be the opposite, wouldn't it? Because he was a defense lawyer. This guy is against Paul. He's trying to hurt him. So, when he was called upon, Tertullus, verse 2, began his accusation saying, seeing that though you were, that through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your foresight, he's building Felix up. He's telling Felix that he's a wonderful guy and he's so thankful that he'd be willing to listen to him. Now, in reality, Felix was a terrible guy. In fact, it was said about him by Tacitus that with savagery and lust, he wielded his power with the power of a king and yet the attitude of a slave. That's what it was said about Felix. He was just an awful person. He was very corrupt. But look what Tertullus is saying. We're so blessed that you are giving us such prosperity and peace. Now, it is true that under Felix's governorship, that he had put down several revolts that had taken place, uprisings against the government. In fact, if you remember, if you go back to chapter 21, verse 38, Claudius Lysias here for a minute mistakes Paul for this Egyptian that started an insurrection against the government. And what had happened historically was that they basically put all these people to death that had listened to this Egyptian, but he had gotten away. And so Lysias' first question was, hey, are you the guy that got away? And you're trying to stir up another group of people against the government. And Paul says, no, I'm a Jew, and I'm from Tarsus of Cilicia. And then he gives them the opportunity to speak. But Felix had been successful in different times at getting rid of people like Paul. And that's kind of what Tertullus is saying. Paul's just like one of these other guys that you free us from. We'll keep going. Verse 3, we accept it always in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from us. For we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him, and wanted to judge him according to our law. Look at verse 7. Verse 7 cracks me up, because I've already read what Lysias said. But the commander Lysias came, and with great violence took him out of our hands. Everyone is really trying to support their own case. You know, Tertullus is talking about how the Jews are basically divine, and they're delivering the whole group of people here from this terrible person, Paul. And this mean commander, Lysias, robbed them of that opportunity, you know. And we remember looking back, Lysias was trying to make sure Paul didn't get torn in pieces. But everybody's lying here, basically what it boils down to. On some level, everyone's lying. Verse 8, commanding his accusers to come to you, by examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him. And all the Jews assented, maintaining that these things were so. So here's Tertullus and everyone behind him, and they're like, that's right, that's how it happened, that's right. Okay, now here's Paul. Paul, after the governor had nodded for him to speak, answered, "Inasmuch as I know that you have been for many years a judge of this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because you may ascertain that it is no more than 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem to worship, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with anyone, nor inciting the crowd, either in the synagogues or in the city. Nor can they prove of the things which they now accuse me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, so I worship the God of my fathers, believing all things which were written in the law and the prophets. I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and unjust. This being so, I myself always strive to have a conscience without offense toward God and men." There's that statement again about his conscience being clean. "Now after many years I came to bring alms and offerings to my nation." That's the collection, right, for the saints that we've been reading about, that was brought and gathered together by all the churches and then delivered by Paul. "In the midst of which some Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with a multitude or with a tumult." We read back to, remember when Paul came to Jerusalem, he participated in a vow to make sure that he was acceptable among the Jews. Here's what Paul's trying to say. "All I did was I came back to Jerusalem. I wanted to come to Pentecost. I brought all this money to help the brethren in my brethren in Judea. And even when I entered the temple, just so I wouldn't offend anybody, I participated in a vow with other people that had that were being cleansed." So Paul's just making his case that he was peaceful. And then he says in verse 19, "They ought to have been here before you to object if they had anything against me. Or else let those who are here themselves say if they found any wrongdoing in me while I stood before the council. Unless it is for this one statement which I cried out standing among them concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged by you this day." Go back to verse 10 and remember how they reacted to that when he said that about the resurrection of the dead. So here's how Felix handles it, verse 22. "When he heard these things, having more accurate knowledge of the way," he had been procurator of Palestine by this time for 7 years, and he only had about 2 years left. "He adjourned the proceedings and said, 'When Lysias the commander comes down, I will make a decision on your case.'" So now Lysias has to come from Jerusalem and also testify. Now whether or not he ever did that, we don't know. So here's the rest. "So he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and let him have liberty, and told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for or visit him. And after some days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning faith in Christ." A little bit about Drusilla. She was Jewish. She was the great-granddaughter of Herod the Great. Herod the Great was the one that put all the babies to death, if you remember, during the time of Jesus in Bethlehem. Also, she was the great-niece of Herod Antipas, who beheaded John the Baptist. And she was the daughter of Agrippa the First, who had martyred James in Acts chapter 12. And it was said that she was probably about 6 years old when this took place. She was also the sister of Herod Agrippa II, who is the Agrippa of Acts chapter 26, who we're going to read about pretty quickly, pretty soon. So she came from a long line of family members who were against Jesus and the work that he did. Like I said, she had been given, by the way, by her brother Agrippa, off to another marriage to a Syrian king. But Felix had convinced her to leave him in her teenage years here and marry him instead. So they were basically living in adultery. So it's here it is, and Paul's going to reason with him about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. He's talking to two individuals in Felix and Drusilla who were political powers, who were given a lot of leniency to do things however they wanted to do them, and were basically immoral. And so it's he has a tough audience here to try to convince. But look what it says here in verse 25. This is a very well-known passage, and one you've heard probably many times in different sermons. "Now, as Paul reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid." Now, you might even have one version says, "Did he trembled?" You have trembled. So, and if I remember right, some of the Greek text on that word tremble meant to literally be knocking at the knees. So, made me think some things about preaching and also about Felix. And look what he says, "Go away for now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you." The goal of preaching, it has to be to convince people of things that are true. I mean, preaching is the gospel, so it's good news. But for people that are wrapped deep in wickedness, it's not good news if they don't change. And so we see in Felix, in being exposed to what Paul taught, some concerns. He wasn't without a mind. He wasn't without a soul. He wasn't without some sense of morality. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been affected by the things that Paul said. So what do you think about that? And when you think about preaching and the goal of preaching and then this response of Felix to be afraid, I know all I've done is talk, and I haven't let any conversation happen. But what do you think about that? When you read this about Felix, what do you think? Yeah. He was confronted with the reality of the life that he was living for a moment. Probably this was not something he normally had to deal with. Someone telling him that he was doing things wrong and that he was going to answer to God for it. And so he was uncomfortable. He was uncomfortable. Think about these three things, too, that he talks about. This is in a sense, the goal of preaching as far as the content. Righteousness. Spoken to him of righteousness. What would that entail, righteousness? In Romans chapter 3, Paul explains that the righteousness of God was revealed through Jesus and his work to reconcile us to God. So righteousness was not only about doing what is right, but I think specifically he wanted to talk to him about who God was, about God's righteousness in spite of our sin, and the plan that would redeem man through Jesus. That's what he was talking about with regard to righteousness. He wasn't talking about self-righteousness. He wasn't talking about moral righteousness. He was talking about the righteousness of God, I believe, and what God had done to buy men back through the blood of Jesus. And then Paul would be in this long conversation. See, he has this conversation. He reasoned with him, verse 25. This must have gone on for hours, and from time to time, they might have met him. We read that later on, he called for him several different times to talk. Now, the reason was mostly he was hoping that Paul would, and maybe his companions, would pay for him to be released and he could kind of be free from any judgment concerning Paul's case because he was afraid to condemn him because he was beginning to become convinced that Paul was innocent. In fact, historians say that one of Felix's major problems was that there was enough evidence to show that Paul was innocent and deserved to be released, but he wouldn't release him. Instead, he kept him bound to do the Jews a favor and to be politically acceptable. And then he left it to Festus when Festus took over when Felix was deposed by Claudius. But so righteousness would have been about the righteousness of God. And I think that Felix was coming to terms with the gospel plan of salvation through Christ. I think Paul taught him that. The second thing is self-control. Now let's talk about self-control with a man who is living with a woman who belongs to someone else. Think about that. Yeah, Roman officials and Roman governors and Roman procurators and Roman emperors, they didn't have to deal with self-control much. They pretty much got to do whatever they wanted to do, and if anyone didn't like it, they would put them to death, right? That's basically what Antipas did with John the Baptist. Remember, John the Baptist says, Herod, it's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Well, let's go ahead and chop his head off, and we can go on with this. Okay, so that's the self-control part of it. Felix would have known that what he was doing and the lifestyle he was living was not in line with the divine God who made him. And then, here's the punchline, what are the results? The results of the righteousness of God to save mankind and his lack of self-control in his sinful life, judgment means what for him? Yeah, those are, you know, in John 8 there, Jesus is saying for the people that abide in the Word, the truth either... It's polarizing, isn't it, the truth? You either have to obey it or you have to reject it. And what does Felix basically do? He tries to do neither. He tries to say, well, let's put this on the shelf for a little while, and maybe when I feel like talking about this again, I'll let you know. That is sometimes the approach that people have to the Word of God. They don't tell you you're terrible for preaching it, but they also don't accept it. What they say is, I don't want to talk about that right now. And And as we see, they never got to the point where they ever obeyed it in its truth. People can brush up against the truth. People can even believe the truth so much to be afraid of what it means. But if they're never obedient, it's never going to do them any good. And that's what happened with Felix. By the way, it says verses 26 and 27, again, he hoped, while he kept him in this 2 years of imprisonment. But it was a prison that was kind of a relaxed prison. Paul had friends that could come and go. And actually, in this 2 years, we have less information about anything that Paul ever did than any other time in his mission work, hoping that he might release him if he was given some money. But he sent for him more often and conversed with him. But it sounds like in verse 26, not because he wanted to hear more about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, but he was hoping that Paul might give him some money, and then he could just let him go and not have to deal with it. He's just, in a sense, another Pontius Pilate trying to wash his hands of the whole affair. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus succeeded Felix, and Felix wanted to do the Jews a favor, left Paul bound. By the way, Felix kind of disappears. And Drusilla, on the other hand, was, along with her son by Felix, she died, and when the eruption of Mount Vesuvius happened and overcame two cities, one of them being Pompeii. So she met a tough demise as well. But there's some history there about Paul's being before Felix, and I hope that it was helpful for you tonight to look at it.